This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
There is a queer idea to every issue, and we will find it. Don't expect us to be nice or politically correct. Nothing is sacred, and we will be finding the queer and profane wherever we can. Is nothing sacred?
Good evening, Joysters. This is Jim Parr here. And I'm on air tonight with a new show, Is Nothing Sacred? And thanks, Pat, for that introduction. Pat's one of our team. And our team tonight is made up of Steph, James and Kurt, who you've heard previously on Fresh Air. We aim to give a bit of a controversial look to different issues that are in the public domain at the moment. And tonight we've got three big issues to talk about. First up, I want to say thank you to Christian for the Vixen Hour. The Vixen Hour is our sort of sister program because they think everything is sacred on the Vixen Hour, everything to do with sex work, but everything is profane as well. So we sort of feel an affinity with the Vixen Hour. But first up tonight, we're actually going to talk about is the Roman Catholic Church above the law, or is the church above the law? And we're going to start it off with James. James is one of the bright young things who's on our panel, and he's a slave to the corporate sector. And he will tell you much more about himself, I'm sure, as the weeks go on. So, James, James has a guest that he wants to talk to about this particular issue, and that is Max Wallace. And Max Wallace, for those who don't know, is an author who has written about the purple economy. The purple economy being about the religious economy, or the economy that is not taxed and so on. Max, are you there?
Yes, good evening. Yes, I'm here.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Max. Just before we get started, I just guess I'd like to introduce a segment. Hi, I'm James, and you've heard me on Fresh Air already with Jim. I believe we might have lost Max, but he'll be back in a sec. So while we get him back on the line, I just want to introduce the topic. So basically, the setting is the current, and I'm sure we've all heard about it in the media, the child sexual abuse that has been occurring, and not just the Catholic Church, but in many other institutions around the country. And in particular, basically it's, you know, are we going to have, out of the new federal inquiry into it, an adequate response so that this never happens again? So in a time, I guess, we have dwindling congregations in churches and a reduction in spirituality throughout Australia, especially in a more organised form, I believe that
Authoritarian,
thank you, Jim. Nature of the Catholic Church in particular has meant that it continues to sort of grow in power. This may mean that we've got a big challenge in terms of making sure that the issues that are found to have caused, the lack of response in terms of the child sexual abuse is actually responded to properly.
Max, are you still with us?
Yes, I am. Yes.
Good.
So, Max, your book, The Purple Economy, you talk about, in particular, the tax-free status of religion. We'll come to that a bit later. There's a new debate that's coming out, particularly in New South Wales at the moment, which is talking more specifically about the child sexual abuse, and realising that the Catholic Church in particular is a non-legal entity at this stage and cannot be sued. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Do you know much about that area in particular?
Yes, I know a few things about it. The Catholic Church in Australia is in fact a series of voluntary associations, and all their assets are tied up in trusts. So
are those voluntary associations, Max, it's Jim here, are those voluntary associations actually protected by their own Acts of Parliament?
No, they are unincorporated associations in that...
So they have no standing in law, really?
Yeah, well, they do to an extent. Any group of people can form themselves into an unincorporated association, but the point is they may have no assets of any significance. And this seems to be the case with the Catholic Church, in that the assets of the Catholic Church are held in trusts. And some of those trusts have legal protection through Acts of Parliament, the state parliaments, and they go back in time over decades. Now, there was a famous case in Australia which reached the High Court, and the Church's position on people suing them, suing their trusts, became known as the Ellis Defence. There was a former lawyer who, as a child, had been abused, and he decided to sue the Church, and he found that, of course, the person who had abused him was either very elderly or in a nursing home and had no assets. So he attempted to sue the Church itself, and that's when he ran into this phenomenon of all their assets being held in a trust. And the Church argues, well, the trust didn't abuse you. This particular priest did, so the trust has got nothing to answer for. Ellis fought this case all the way to the High Court, and he lost, which means that the assets of the Church in Australia are yet to be breached in a formal sense, although there is a recent claim in David Marr's excellent article on child abuse in the Church that, off the record, people are saying that they've settled for something like $100 million. But in the scheme of things, that would still be a small amount.
So, Max, basically in practical terms, with all of these horror stories that people hear about in the news about, you know, suicides resulting from sexual abuse, but more importantly, people living with mental, you know, problems throughout their life caused by such events, there's no technical way, apart from going to perhaps arbitration, as you touched on, that they can actually hold the Catholic Church to account. Is that right?
Yes, that's the problem. And unlike the United States, where abuse has cost them billions, in Australia the situation is much different. And one of the problems that victims have in Australia is, of course, that the Church in Australia saw the problem coming and set up Towards Healing. And this was the Church-administered system where the argument was, well, if you come to us, to our supposedly independent panel, we will deal with your problem and we'll settle it more or less in-house without having to go through the legal system, and we'll pay you some compensation. But compensation was originally set at a maximum of $50,000. I understand it's now been increased to $75,000. And so victims who had experienced dreadful sexual abuse and other kinds of abuse were settling for trivial sums of money. And I think that was the whole purpose and function of Toward Healing, was to hose down claims. And
Max, are the Catholics unique in this in Australia? Do any of the other churches have this protection?
Well, they all throw stumbling blocks in the way of people wanting to settle. I think it's probably easier to... No, let me correct that. I think you would find that if you were to sue any of the other major churches in Australia, you would run into the same problem, that there would be lawyers, there would be endless delays, and you would probably find that their assets, like the Catholic Church's, are also in trusts.
So, Max, thank you so much for your insight into this. moving forward, then you're saying that even if legislation, and I believe there's legislation to New South Wales at the moment, to at least address the issue relating to the Catholic Church and making sure that they can be sued, but you're saying that there are enormous, you know, issues that confront people because of the huge wealth of such organisations. I think it has been quoted that if it was incorporated, the Catholic Church in New South Wales, for instance, would be either the fourth or fifth wealthiest entity. You know quite a bit about wealth and how they're able to amass such wealth. How in Australia, or in particular, you know, difference from other places in the world, have they been able to amass such wealth?
Well, look, we really don't know that much about the wealth of the Catholic Church beyond what they've been prepared to tell us in Australia. We know that they're the largest landholder in Australia, and it's likely that they're the largest private employer. But as to the total amount of their assets and the total amount of their annual revenue, we're not too sure. In New Zealand, some years ago, the government there set up a charities commission, and it had a reporting requirement. And it's still the case today, even though the Charities Commission in New Zealand has been downgraded and to a section within internal affairs. Religious organisations in New Zealand have to report their assets to the government, to
and
the
not
Charities
so here.
Commission, annually. Now, it was decided a couple of years ago that an Australian Charities Commission would be set up. But very curiously, a requirement for religious organisations to report their wealth was absent from the legislation. There was no requirement.
And so why do you think that is, Max?
Well, lobbying behind the scenes by the Catholic Church is... In fact, there was an article in the Sunday Age a few weeks ago saying that not only does the Catholic Church not want to have a reporting requirement, but they want the whole Charities Commission to be abolished.
And is that they've been pushing that through Kevin Andrews, I understand, is that right?
That's what the article was alleging, my memory of it.
Has the Catholic Church made strategic appointments to their trusts so that they've got the most influential people they can find as trustees? Or are they just ordinary people who are the trustees that own St. Patrick's Cathedral?
I can't answer that question. That's a very detailed question. That would require corporate searches to
absolutely
do.
Well, sorry, Max, just bring it back because we are heading to out of time, unfortunately, because it's been so... I've learnt so much. We basically having a look, actually, there was also an article in the Sydney Morning Herald and Age recently, so Fairfax Papers, which basically looked at, you know, the well-publicised gender breakdown in the new cabinet of federal parliament. And the reason I think it's relevant is because obviously there's a federal inquiry and that parliament will be obviously making the laws and potentially changing them afterwards. There's also a huge change in the amount of Catholic men in particular. Do you have confidence that the new federal parliament will be able to enact appropriate law changes and reforms to make sure that this never happens again in terms of sexual abuse, but also, you know, other issues that are dear to you, such as tax issues?
Well, it's going to be quite some time before the Federal Royal Commission reports and their recommendations will have to come forward. And it will depend on the nature of those recommendations, that what the new federal government's going to do about it. It could take years before the commission reports. Now, let's say, for argument's sake, that the Abbott government is still in power at that time. It's a tricky question in that if there are serious recommendations about reform and government regulation of religion in some respect or other, it's going to be fascinating to watch how they're going to respond to this. Because
there are more old boys of St. Ignatius College Riverview in Sydney in the cabinet than there are women.
You'll find that the government, I think, is going to be caught between a rock and a hard place in that their credibility in terms of dealing with this issue is going to be put to the test, because bear in mind that over the next few years, there's going to be a lot of exposure of things that we don't know about at this point in time. And I think it's going to get a lot worse.
Well, look, Max, thank you so much. Diplomatic as ever, very eloquent answers there. I think we were hoping for something a bit more gutsy, but no, but thank you very much for your time, and we'll let you go. We'll let you head off. But it's certainly a lot to think about, and I think we'd compel our listeners to certainly be that voice in the community so that we get the change and reform that is desperately needed in this area. And we would also encourage our listeners to buy and purchase and read your fantastic book, The Purple Economy.
Well, The Purple Economy is out of print now, so you'll have to find it in libraries. Just to finish on one point, we did a search in New Zealand. We found out the churches in New Zealand are worth $11 billion.
Mm.
So if you were to multiply that by a factor of so many, they would be extremely rich in Australia. And that would explain why they don't want a reporting requirement, why they don't want a charities commission, because they don't want the public to know how wealthy they really are.
Well, they don't want to know about all that CBD land that they own, with things like the op shops on them, or all those places like Sanitarium that are owned by a church, not a Catholic church.
There's a huge story there.
I wish we had time for it. Thank you so much, Max, and hopefully we at some point get to see and speak to you again.
No problem.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Max. So, people, Joy listeners, please SMS us on 0427JOY949 or email us on air at joy.org.au, or go to our Facebook page, which is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9, which you can find if you go to the joy.org.au webpage and go straight there.
And I believe there's just a little bit of material that we've put up there about the recent legislation, so please go ahead and have a look at that.
Yes, we have posted about this issue on the Facebook page, so you can go and read the various articles if you're interested about it.
You're with James, Kurt, Steph and Pat on Is Nothing Sacred? Joy 94.9.
You're on Joy 94.9 and this is Nothing Sacred. We do have an SMS has come in from Danielle in Clayton. Thanks, Danielle. She says, excellent segment. I think that as a secular nation, the churches should be treated as the business enterprises they are, but be able to have the charity offshoots on a tax-free basis, provided that they open to the same scrutiny as everyone else. I think I would agree with you 100% on that, Danielle. If you keep on making comments like that, please go and make them on our Facebook page as well, and you might even find that you're in here one day being on the panel. So we're encouraging listeners to participate through our Facebook page. Go to the joy.org.au Facebook page and follow the links to Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. Or email us, as Danielle has just done, on onair@joy.org.au. Or SMS us on 0427JOY949. And I think that is an interesting topic, the church and the law and how far above it is. I remember my grandmother as a child telling me that if you were a Catholic, you could never get a job at Sanitarium because it was owned by the Seventh-day Adventists. And if you were anything but a Catholic, you couldn't get a job at Kraft because that was owned by the Catholics. So, and Sanitarium is still a church-owned business in this country now. So I think we need to be thinking very carefully about where this goes in the future of the Australian polity. Well, next up, we're going to have Steph, one of our other young panellists. And Steph is a Gen Y lesbian.
That's fair to say. I don't think that's particularly controversial so far, Jim.
And she flies through the air with the women's circus occasionally.
Flies, yes, I suppose so. I think I'm stronger in the policy sphere than in the circus sphere.
And she is a social policy analyst and a consultant. So we might have her write a new policy about church and state, perhaps, secularism. But tonight, Steph's actually going to tell us what is wrong with prisons and why they don't work.
Yes, I am indeed. So this is something that I'm interested to talk about. It is controversial. The brief I was given from you, Jim, was to be controversial. So I've picked a controversial topic and a controversial song. But what I would like to talk about today is why prisons don't work. And I think One thing that I've noticed in talking to people is that people see prisons as a maybe an endpoint, somewhere that you send people you don't want hanging around, rather than thinking about what happens next. But the thing is that, well, for a start, prisons are really expensive. The cost is about $300 per prisoner per day in Victoria, depending on what kind of prisoner people are in. So this is millions of dollars, millions and millions of dollars that we're spending on prisons. The state government is building more and more of them. Certainly the prison population continues to rise, even though the rate of crime continues to fall. And there's usually three main reasons given to why people should be put in prison. So one is about punishment for the crime they've committed.
So it's the climate of fear.
It is the climate of fear. But I mean, obviously, there is a place for prison. Well, not obviously. Some people believe there isn't a place for prison in society. I think there is a role for prison, but certainly one that is smaller than it is now. Because the three reasons that people usually give, one around punishment, one about rehabilitating prisoners, and another about public safety, it's really only the third of those three reasons that has any validity in terms of being
effective.
Has
anybody ever found a rehabilitation program in a prison?
Sorry?
Has anyone ever found a rehabilitation program inside a prison?
Well, there are rehabilitation programs in prisons in terms of people having mental health support and drug and alcohol support and training. But the thing is that these are pretty limited and in an environment that is not reflective of the world outside. It's also limited in a couple of ways. For example, people on short sentences can't necessarily get access to courses, and the compulsory nature can reduce the level to which people are engaged. But even the impact of being inside prison means that people are mixing with other offenders. They're getting this idea about the normalisation of crime.
A college for crime, in other words.
Well, yeah, I suppose it is a place where people connect for increasing their offending. And one of the biggest risk factors for offending is being in prison previously. So going to prison doesn't actually stop someone from offending in the future. It makes them more likely to offend, which is pretty bad, obviously, for the offender themselves, who then goes back to prison again, which has massive impacts for them and their family. They lose their house. But also for the victims, if we think about the final goal, which I believe is trying to reduce crime, what I believe we should be doing is having policies and practices that actually reduce crime. And to be honest, prison isn't really one of them, because by sending someone to prison, you make them angry. They meet other people have this normalised idea about crime. They're separated from their family.
And people that heard us on Fresh Air last week might have heard us actually talking about the role of diversionary programs to keep people out of prison.
Mm.
And there's not a great deal of diversion that goes on in the system. There is some diversion that goes on in the system, but I would argue that there's a lot more diversionary policy required and diversionary programs required. I mean, the Netherlands, for instance, is actually closing prisons at the moment because they've got too many prison beds. Mm. Perhaps we could just...
Well, what I think is about...
We could turn the boats around and send them to the Netherlands.
Good luck with that. What I think we should be doing is, rather than locking people up in this environment that makes them angry and scared and more likely to offend, is that we should be addressing the causes of the crime. And the reality is that a lot of crime that is committed is by people who have experienced quite significant trauma. People who are in prison are more likely to have acquired brain injury, intellectual disability. Some crime is committed when people are affected by drug and alcohol or forms of mental illness, including psychosis. So what I would be suggesting is divert funds away from the prisons and into things like mental health facilities, drug and alcohol treatment. And I do agree there is a role to play for very violent criminal offenders, particularly sex offenders, in terms of keeping people perhaps in a secure mental health inpatient facility. Or
but are there arguments to be made, Steph, for having sort of community-based attention, so that people wearing electronic armbands and wristbands and ankle bands and that sort of thing, so that they can be monitored where they are?
Yeah, I think there is a role for that. Because, one of the things that is a big risk factor for offending is people feeling disconnected from the community. So the more someone is connected to the community in terms of having friends who aren't offenders, in terms of being linked in with their family, if their family is a positive influence in their life, having a job, having a house, these are the things that reduce the risk of people offending in the future. So by making those connections, then we can actually reduce crime and we have so far.
And so we've seen people go to jail for all sorts of things, that spurious things that are no longer crimes. For instance, some gay men used to go to jail for actually having loving relationships once.
I'm glad that doesn't happen anymore.
So this is a matter of some importance, I think, because, in fact, one of the things that the gay community has been arguing for in Victoria is the wiping of offences that occurred under the old anti-homosexual laws, because they haven't yet been wiped. So people that were convicted under those laws are still on the criminal justice record as having a criminal background. And in some places in the world, and in some states, have actually got rid of those prior convictions. So we should argue that they should go here as well. I noticed that in the United States, there's been quite a lot of work done on the communities in prisons, and particularly the way in which prisons affect gay and lesbian inmates. And they affect gay and lesbian inmates quite significantly. And I would think they would affect people who were trans or people with intersex.
Well, certainly one link that springs to mind for me is in terms of risk factors for things like homelessness. If you have young gay, lesbian, trans people who are perhaps kicked out of home as a result of being gay or lesbian or trans or queer, ending up on the street, like, we know that the homeless young people are more likely to be part of our community than... they're overrepresented, I suppose, compared to the general population. And then it is those kind of factors, such as being homeless, not having links, not being able to get a job because you don't have a house, that then people are more likely to lead to crime. So I don't...
Here's a challenge for the Victorian gay and lesbian rights lobby, isn't it? To actually start lobbying hard for the rights of young homeless gay and lesbians, trans and intersex people, to try and get them and set up specific diversion programs for them, to get them out of the milieu of the criminal justice system and away from jail. Because once they go to jail, they are far more likely, according to the US reports, to be abused. And the Human Rights Watch in New York put out a big report in 2011 on sex in prisons that basically said all male-to-male sex in prison was rape, because even though there were some consensual relationships in prison, most of those, the consensus was gained through fear. It was people who were looking for the protection of really strong prisoners, and the really strong prisoners were looking for a sexual outlet. So I suspect there's quite a lot of abuse and so on that goes on in prisons that we need to be concerned about, and it's something that no doubt we could take up, and it would be a challenge in our community to stop thinking about equal marriage and start thinking about the rights of young homeless gays and lesbians.
Well, I certainly think the first step is for people to think about what happens next, because especially things like watching CSI or Law and Order, often what happens is people are in court and there's the sentence and the person gets sent to prison and that's the end of the episode. So I think those kinds of media ideas, encourage this idea of thinking about prison as an end point rather than as a starting point or something where people are going round and round in terms of going in and out of prison, because once they've been disconnected.
And one of the big indicators of going to prison is the fact that you come from a family of prisoners.
Well, that's the thing. That's certainly another big risk factor. If a child has a parent who's been to prison, they're more likely to end up in prison themselves, which for me is another reason to have diversionary programs to keep people out of prison, particularly if we're talking about people who are in prison not for violent offences, but things like petty theft, stealing handbags, or things that are not violent. If we can keep those people out of prison, perhaps in something, a community program, or stopping them getting to that point of desperation with improved community services, not only are we keeping them out, but potentially keeping their children out as well. And something
Steph,
else...
In the work that you've done on social policy in prisons, are the diversionary programs volunteer-based at all, or any of them engage volunteers in the work that they do, or are they all professionally based?
I know a lot of the diversionary programs are staffed by staff, I suppose, not volunteers, but there are certainly volunteer roles that people can take on at prisons. I volunteer through the Red Cross at the Women's Prison in Deer Park, and I know also the Red Cross also has a program with young people playing sport in prisons. There's certainly ways that people can engage if they're interested. There's also programs inside prisons with, say, parents and children to run craft activities. So if people are interested, there's certainly ways that they can support those families.
Is Nothing Sacred with Pat, James, Kurt and Steph. Joy 94.9.
You're on Joy 94.9. This is Nothing Sacred with Jim Parr, that's me, Steph, James and Kurt. And Kurt is about to regale us with his thoughts of the week. We are here to talk about current affairs or issues of some controversy, and the brief that I gave to the panel tonight was pick something that's dear to your heart and a bit controversial, and here we go. And I believe that Kurt is a young trans man, so he rounds out our panel of Gen Y's and Gen X's quite nicely, and he's going to talk to us about the perennial gay issue of pets. It's over to you, Kurt.
Thanks, Jim. Yeah, I just wanted to talk about the social welfare of pets. There are many social welfare benefits of owning a pet. They offer us absolute loyalty and support, but still society, I feel, is failing them.
Aren't they slaves?
They are not slaves, Jim. I think anyone who has ever owned a pet can vouch for the companionship, the sense of well-being, the love and
That's
the hilarity.
Dogs. You own dogs. Dogs have masters, cats have slaves.
That's right. I'd agree with that. But look, I want to mainly talk about dogs just because they bring so much to our lives. Jim, I know that you have a dog.
And how many fur babies do you have, Kurt?
I've got two fur babies, and they are my children. I think a lot of gay and lesbian and trans people would say that their fur babies are like their children, just because of the fact that a lot of us can't have actual children. And
pets I have to say that when Kurt comes to my house, he's like the doting uncle. And he spoils my dog shamelessly.
Well, I don't put cream on his nose. We all saw it, Jim.
Nobody would, of course. It was his birthday today, by the way.
Oh, was it?
Didn't get cream on his nose for his birthday today.
Oh, well, you'll have to get him to give me a call and I'll wish him happy birthday. look, I just wanted to talk about companion animal welfare failure. It begins with allowing uneducated idiots to walk into a pet shop and buy any pet they want without any questions asked. This shopper is able to...
But isn't this a good reason to have the Oscars Law legislation go through that bans the sale of puppies and kittens through pet shops?
Yeah, Oscars Law has its limits. It only bans certain breeders and... it basically legislates certain breeders to run there's different cage sizes and standards that they have to live up to, but there's still breeding is still cruel because there are so many homeless cats and dogs out there who need homes when people are just sort of buying new ones from breeders. They're all, half of them are inbred with a lot of medical issues and they just get dumped or abandoned whenever the owner gets sick of them, and they just sort of get treated like a toy.
And Joy listeners can hear more about this on Fridays at 12 noon when we have Pets Allowed, the Lost Dogs Home show, which is a very popular show here on Joy. And the Lost Dogs Home team are always talking about the welfare of pets. But we can talk about the social the benefits to us for the welfare of pets, but what about the welfare of the pets themselves? I did actually, when I was doing a bit of hunting around about the social welfare of pets today, Kurt, find a terrific satirical report on the Daily Mail on the web. And as anybody that knows the big wide interweb, the Daily Mail is one of those those websites like Gawker or The Onion and so on. And it had a terrific report about how the fur babies of gays and lesbians did much worse at doggy sports than the fur babies of straight people.
I think it's because they're all spoiled.
Fat.
And fat, yeah. Because people give them cream.
Not in my house.
Never. I'll be listening when the Lost Dogs Home show is on. I think it's, really important part of gays and lesbians' lives. But I just wanted to throw some ideas out there for prevention for people treating animals like a possession rather than treating them like their children. I've actually read an article today, which I've posted on our Is Nothing Sacred Facebook page, that was about some research done with MRIs done on dogs. And
you mean they wasted good research and MRI money on putting dogs through MRI machines? How do they make them stay still long enough to...
They actually began with a dummy MRI machine and trained the dogs to go in there. Usually professionals would say to anaesthetise the dogs before they went in, but it makes it hard to measure emotions and other brain activity if they're anaesthetised. So they actually trained the dogs to go in a dummy MRI machine, and they treated it like they would if they were researching on voluntary children.
So all the dogs would have been super happy in there because they knew they were going to get some food when they came out the other end.
That's right, yeah. And they measured their brain waves for the hand signal for food, and it was the same reaction for... I think it's called the caudate nucleus, which humans have as well. It was the same reaction for a child who would experience love, food and joy. So they basically came to the conclusion that...
dogs really are our fur babies.
They are, yeah. Dogs have a level of sentience comparable to a human child. So I think we really should...
I've seen some of those children on the tram, and I don't know that that would actually be true. I think some dogs are more sentient than
I'd agree. I prefer dogs over children any day. But I think we should not call it an ownership. We should call it a guardianship, because they are children.
Except for cats, because you're the slave of a cat.
Except for cats. Cats are our guardians.
They certainly are. I can tell you they are at my house anyway.
Yeah, so I know you're an animal lover, Jim, so I know that you can't really talk back to me. I know that you're agreeing with me.
Well, I am agreeing with you to a large extent. I'm for the banning of puppies and kittens through pet shops. And I now notice that the pet shops have sort of caught up with this, because I went past the one in my shopping centre yesterday and it was full of giant lop-eared rabbits, whatever those they might be. I looked at them and thought, I could get one of those and put it in the backyard. It would give my Abyssinian cat some sport. He could chase it round. And then they've got hamsters and guinea pigs and things like that, and they'd last about a minute in my house, I think. If they're anything like the river rats that come up from the Yarra and end up spread eagled across the carpet under my bed every day.
They're waiting for you.
They certainly are. There'll be a gift when I get home tonight, I have no doubt. But you're on Joy 94.9. This is Nothing Sacred. And we're listening to Kurt talking about his fur babies and why they should be given voting rights or something like that.
almost voting rights. We'll get there one day. But I've chosen the song Ben by Michael Jackson. Jim might think it's...
This is the whiniest song that we've had all night. Unlike the wonderful Amanda Palmer. That wasn't the Dresden Dolls, everybody. That was Amanda Palmer that we heard last time with Map of Tasmania. And Steph is already tweeting her to tell her that she's been played on the radio, even though the first line, as Steph said, of the song was, this song is never played on the radio. Yes, it is.
We'll report back next week if she tweets back to us.
Oh, good. And you can, people... can't tweet us yet because we don't have a Twitter handle, but we will have eventually. But you can SMS us on 0427 joy 949, or you can email us on onair@joy.org.au, and we'd really like you to do that. And we would really, really like you to go to our Facebook page, because we are hoping to have On Is Nothing Sacred a regular segment at some stage called Smashing the Sacred Cow. If anybody wants to smash the sacred, wants to nominate a sacred cow that needs to be smashed, please go to our Facebook page and tell us, or send us an email on air@joy.org.au, and you might be smashing the sacred cow in here at some stage. So thanks very much, everybody, for listening. This is number one show of Is Nothing Sacred. We will be back again next week with number two, and hopefully we will be raising a few more controversial issues for you to listen to. So thanks very much to Pat for announcing us at the beginning, and Pat's going to be one of our revolving panel. And thanks to Kurt and James and Steph.
Thanks Jim. See you next week.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.